Hi, good morning, everybody. I want to propose something a little bit different in the next hour. I want to try and reframe the question because I really believe that the proposals that we have at present, good or bad, and we can, if you want, discuss that, are not really relevant because I doubt anything of substance more is going to actually happen. But the damage which has emerged, I won't say caused, which has emerged, is not going away. And using a well-worn metaphor, the genie that's been released from our particular bottle can't be rebottled so easily, nor necessarily should it. Let me just close the door behind me because there's a lot of kids playing here. Once. And as I think we're just at the beginning of a difficult and to some extent dangerous path, I also think it's far better to plan the future forward, except that it's going to be a rocky and somehow not easy to bypass path we're going forward towards, and realize that with difficult compromises and new ideas are going to have to be worked through. Because otherwise, I believe the vector of our state has changed. Let me explain what I mean by that last sentence. For years now, I've been talking in many places around the country, I've had the honor of doing so with you as well, about the fact that we're going through some sort of tribal realignment. For the first 50 years of our national existence, from the late 20s, when Ben Gurion set up the Histadrut, which was the prototype of the Mdina in its formation, until the late 70s, when finally Ben Gurion's tribe, let's call it for the sake of today's shiur, the secular tribe, finally gave up after 10 tumultuous years the reins to the next tribe, the Masoretim, led by Menachem Begin. And it took years for that to settle down as well. And they've now been with us nearly 50 years. But in the last 10 years of their rule, from probably 2017, and probably to the end of this decade, there will be a period, I suspect, of instability, of a lack of direction until the next tribe, which I've always believed will be the tribe of the Tzionut HaDatit, being their four tribes of the Jewish people in our generation, will finally be able to lead this country. But the way we will lead it, and whether we'll be able to avoid a civil war in so doing, is something which I've always been positive about until this year. I always felt that the vector is a positive one. Demographics doing what they do, ideals doing what they do, and the very fact that we spent so much time in our generation educating a very special, highly committed group of people who are now fathers to children themselves would enable us to move from one tribe to another without real disruption, without, God forbid, leading to the very threatening of that little state which we received some 75 years ago from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and which, as you all know, is something of a discrepancy and anomaly in our longer Jewish history. I'm no longer sure that I was right. For the first time, I believe that the vector, the direction of movement, has shifted from being something which may be a little bit unpleasant and yet manageable to a new tribal leadership, that of the Tzionut HaDatit, to something which may, if something is not done, become inevitably similar to nearly all third, fourth generation transformations in history, which is a period of sustained and substantial and painful civil intestine warfare, many times actually being warfare. I'm not going to take a large part of the shiur now, giving you all the historical examples. You know them from our history. You know them from American history. I can show you from British history as well. It happens most of the time. It happens nearly all the time, where you leave fundamental issues unresolved at the time of founding of a state. And 70, 80, 90 years later, the third generation, unable to paper over the discrepancies, the differences, try all sorts of compromises and all sorts of debates and discussions and think tanks and petitions, and everything good is tried, and some not so good things as well. But nearly always in history, they fail, and it leads to some sort of very challenging civil interlocution, or sometimes war itself, from which a strengthened political community emerges. We hope and pray that we will be a historical anomaly. We'll be different, that we won't need to go through that terribly damaging, dangerous, and awful period, and it is awful, of civil fighting and of civil war. And I always believed until recently, until 6 months ago, that that's what was going to happen. We were so different in so many ways that we're going to be different in this way as well. But I no longer believe that. And I, like so many others, like everybody, I think, was surprised and dismayed by the strength, the intensity of the objections to something which should have been obvious. You heard Shurim by people wiser than myself who explain why the legislation is basically cosmetic, normative, in keeping with every other democracy in the world. So it's not the legislation. Something much, much more profound is going on here. Something much more disturbing is happening. Nor am I referring to the 10, 20% on, let's call it the left, who are professional troublemakers, ego seekers, or funded by foreign interests whose sole desire is to retain some sort of power for themselves. They exist on the right, but they exist in far greater intensity and a much bigger threat on the left. The left always looks like that throughout modern history. I'm not talking about them. We could beat them. They're not large in number, and they're weak in commitment and in intensity. My concern is the legitimate feeling of a good third of the country, making up the vast bulk of the people who object to what we call the reforms today, who genuinely feel that their way of life is being threatened. Let's not get bogged down with issues of totalitarianism, democracy, even liberal thought. It's so far-fetched and it's so far removed from the real description of these terms, it's not worth trying to bridge. Those are not the issues. It's not difficult to understand what's really happening. The issues, simply put, are this: who will decide our values going forward? Everybody who doesn't agree understands now that eventually elections over the next 20, 50 years have already been decided. They think they're wrong, but they think. And they think there are more and more people who think differently from themselves, primarily Haredim in their idea, in their mind, whose values are not their values, and who through the regular democratic process of majoritarian rule, and it makes little difference if you do a Piskatit Geburut at 64 or 65 or 70, you're going to reach those numbers in any event. In their thinking, they're a little wrong, but it doesn't really matter. That's what they believe, and they're not so wrong in that. And they ask themselves, who will protect us? Who will protect the values for which we think we have lived? We have been prepared to sacrifice, and in many cases have sacrificed our lives, risk our children's lives for. We disagree so intensely with the other's life values that we cannot accept the idea that they will dictate from now forward for the next 50 years whose values will dominate our political conversation, our political society. And that's what's worrying them. They're frightened. They're fearful. I don't need to explain to you that fear and suspicion lead inevitably to hate, which leads inevitably to civil war. And that's where the vector's going now. It doesn't quite matter what amendment is achieved, what committees are set up. They are completely and totally irrelevant, in my opinion, given the emotions, given the real genuine feels, the fears which have emerged through the last 6 months and are not going away, regardless of what happens over the next few months. Nor can they be resolved top downwards, as I explain in my shi'ur. You can't set up a committee, distinguished as they may be, a Sanhedrin, profound as they may be, to resolve the issues from above. It never works in history. There's no reason it'll work here either. So we have a real challenge. If before we were trying to steer the ship, gently nudge it into a more accurate direction, Now we know that if we don't manage to shift fundamentally the compass to a new setting, we are going to arrive where everybody else arrives after 70, 80, 90 years of democracy, at a setting where two parts of the country, at the very least, can't live together. One side or the other or both call in for foreign intervention to help protect them from the other. And the road to civil war is nearly unstoppable. Will it happen tomorrow? No. Will it happen in 3 years? No. But the vector is clear, and it will happen unless we do something to prevent it. Assuming that there is something you can do to prevent it, and I'm not 100% convinced it's possible, but at the very least, we have to try. And that's what I'm going to be presenting over the next 50 minutes. But I'm going to stop to have a sip of tea every few minutes. And I would appreciate it if, instead of it waiting to the end when you've forgotten what you want to ask or disagree with me, stop. And if it's on the subject, I'll answer. If it requires more profound discussion, I'll make a note and answer it at the end.
Well, Shlomo, already what you're suggesting is that the body politic here in Israel doesn't want democracy as we understand it, because they're not going to get the outcome that they want. So democracy no longer works in the country.
Let's try and avoid terminological fights. Democracy, non-democracy, let's try and talk about the underlying issues and values beyond that, and then be really practical what we can actually do rather than theoretize. We could argue from tomorrow until tomorrow about what democracy is, how you define it, how liberal it should be. I remind you that the original democracies are incredibly illiberal. For most of human history, even modern human history, democracy is something which we wouldn't recognize today as being a liberal democracy. And yet liberal democracy is challenged all over the world today because it leads to a sense, a lack of meaning, identity, a lack of understanding who we are, and therefore doesn't satisfy the basic human urge for meaning and for giving meaning to life's sacrifice. So you can argue about democracy. I'm going to come back to what the Jewish alternative is in a minute. This, after all, is a Shia, not a political lecture. And I want to steer it towards Torani issues as well, if I may. And I'll explain why. Because, as I said in my opening remarks, I firmly believe that the next tribe up to lead this nation is us. And us being the broader term for all the Tzibur Dati Lumi, which seems so disjointed, so disunited, so fragmented today, which is all a tova, because we need to rebuild our us very urgently and rebuild it differently than we had. But at the core of the us is a real commitment to values which come in a broader sense from our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In Kepes, in the Torah, however we understand it. I mean, although we admire, and although we are great adherents of liberal democratic thinking and are true believers in many of its tenets, in the end, our fundamental meaning comes from the fact that we are, kodem kol, firstly committed to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, firstly committed to understanding and keeping his Torah, and second of all, to applying that through our liberal democratic eyes to the world around us. That's what makes us different. That's the special gift that we now can bring to the Jewish people, who is drifting unanchored to any sort of tradition, any anchored from any sort of relationship to Kodesh Baruch Hu. So when I say our tribe is taking over, it's taking over in a sense that the responsibilities we shouldered until now will be as nothing compared to the weight and burden of responsibilities which history is going to ask us to start shouldering from now onwards. And it's going to take a few years, probably the end of the decade, before we have some sort of clear vision, before we leaders emerge that can articulate that vision and can inspire enough people from other tribes to create a unified leadership. So they are rooted in Torah, but they have to be urgently relevant to the whole world. They can't end up being Torani concepts to people who don't yet recognize the value, the sanctity, the critical relevance of things being rooted in Torah. Let me start from where I ended up in my last year to you. It doesn't matter if you don't remember what I said. I just don't repeat myself because he won't pay me so much. The last time I tried to distinguish between nation and state, it's an idea which appears throughout modern Jewish thinkers. A lot of my thinking today comes from Professor Daniel Elazar, Zichron Oli Vracha, who many of you remember or at least know of, from Rabbi Sachs, Zichron Oli Vracha, from Ashkenazi Minito, Zichron Oli Vracha, and from contemporary thinkers who expound and try and merge their thought. I've tried, after studying and teaching these people for many years, to create some unified theory which answers our question. Because in the end, I'm a practical guy. In the end, I'm neither a philosopher nor an academician. I'm a guy who wants to get things done and wants to encourage others with me to get things done together. But for that, we need guidance. For that, we need teachers and mentors who will show us how we connect Kadosh Baruch Hu's Torah to the challenges of our generation. And let's briefly touch on the five big challenges, or at least political challenges, that I think we are facing here in Eretz Israel today. And they're much, much broader than issues of constitutional reform, but they do fit into them. And the first one is, and has become recently, that of how we decide our values. You can call it constitutional reform, but at its heart, it's who decides how we should live, by what values we should live, how we prioritize one thing more than another. That's what values is all about. Who decides? How are we committed to those values? Is it a democratic process? Is it an oligarchic process? Is it a process where you share some sort of democracy with an unelected body of wise men, which is how many countries, including Israel, run themselves today? That's what Bagatz is, an unelected body of wise, so-called wise men. So how we decide our values as a nation, as a people, is an urgent and pressing challenge, but somehow I suspect not the hardest of the five political challenges we're facing today as a people. That's number one, and then up in an ascending order. The other challenge is, how, as we are Jewish people, do we live in a country in which 25% of the people who live here are non-Jews, Arabs, Christians, Muslims, and in my thinking, Kadosh Baruch Hu wants them to live here and wants them to feel proud of being part of our political entity. How do we do that? The Torah Shebaal Peh has next to no instructions, next to no thinking on the subject. And what it does is convoluted and downright weird. But the Torah Shebichtav is full of it. Just we haven't used that part of Torah Shebichtav for nearly 2,700 years, apart from a flash at the time of the Chashmonaim, where we got a F, we failed on understanding how to live with the other. Not since the early monarchy of the Jewish people have we had control over, need to administer, need to rule over, Be'ein Hashem, B'tzedek u'b'mishpat, over non-Jews. How do we do it? And yet, and I think I've given shiurim here, and I talk about this, and I teach the issue, and yet the Torah Shebichtav is chock full of pasuk achrei pasuk, of parshia achrei parshia, of how HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to relate to the non-Jew living in our midst. And when we do so, in the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu, at least the way I understand it, asks us to do, we act not only as an example to others in our midst, but to the whole world who is facing similar challenges of how others, most countries, most major countries, have 15 to 20 to 25% of others living in their midst who don't identify with their national cultural heritage. And they are challenged to understand, how do you relate to their culture? Multiculturalism doesn't really work. Pluralism seems to run out of energy, and the world's shifting in many places again towards some sort of nationalistic ethic with its own inherent evils. So the question how we decide those values is only secondary to the question of how we live with a non-Jew in our midst politically. Then we have other urgent pressing issues. There's a huge tribe of the Jewish people, a critically important tribe, one who's up next after us in about 50 years' time. Not sure I'll be there to see it, which will call the Charedim, and they seem to have cut themselves off to a great extent. Is that happening? How can we reconnect them? How can we as the Jewish people not lose the vitality and the good which they represent? And how can we reconnect them to the political body, which is the Jewish state, which is the only political body we have as a nation today? Next challenge up is the diaspora. We're losing the diaspora. Nobody really cares, apart from the Tzionim Datim, to a great extent, that we're losing the diaspora. 50% of the Jewish people is going, and soon to be gone. But we care. Now, realistically, most of it's going to go. That's what has always happened through history. How can we hold on to 10, 20, 30, 40%? How can we give them a meaningful role whilst they're there? Because most of them are not coming unless, God forbid, they become persecuted. How can we create a role, a meaningful role, for a person who lives in Brooklyn or Golders Green and yet doesn't want to come and live in Israel, but has deep and important connections through children, through service? through Aliyah LeRegel, and we've spoken about that in previous Shirim as well. And finally, the greatest challenge of all, how can we carry on as a ever-progressing, ever-enlightened society, believing as we do in liberal democratic values, and yet accept the fact, Shehashem shochen betochenu. I don't know what Mikdash means. But to me, Mikdash fundamentally means that a Kodesh Baruch Hu's presence is nearly visible, certainly tangible in our midst. How can we recreate space for a Kodesh Baruch Hu in our midst without talking about building Mizbeach, and it's all very important, but I'm not sure that's really what a Kodesh Baruch Hu wants us to be involved with. I don't know. He doesn't talk to me. But when I think about Mikdash, to me, the question is, how do we allow space for a Kodesh Baruch Hu's presence, real presence in our midst, given the fact that now and going forward, Jews have different levels of commitment, if at all, to his presence, to his commandments, to being committed to him. From extremely committed like we are, to less and less and less committed, to the vaguely non-committed, who make up probably today 70% of the Tzibur HaChiloni b'Mdinat Yisrael. So how do we give answers to those political challenges is going to answer the question how we serve the Jewish people as its coming leaders in the next decade. And they are huge challenges. And I can tell you one thing, as a person who's had time the last few years to study, to lecture, and to listen to the best of our thinkers, there is very little out there to go on. We begin to understand the challenges. We know we need to find something new, something fresh. Or as political scientists like to say, we need to reframe the question. We're not sure how to go about answering those challenges. But it's conditional on our ability as a community to provide those answers. It's a condition of us being a successful tribe or successful leaders of the Jewish people, as inevitably we will be once this decade is out. And what I want to start doing in the last 40 minutes of my shiur now is to give you one idea, or to develop one strand of thinking which indicates, or at least shows, a beginning of a path towards solving some. I can't resolve here in the next 40 minutes all those questions, but answers exist. Answers exist, in my opinion, throughout the Tanakh, because we as Jews have been there before. We do believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us, through being inspired learning Torah, the ability to see in the Torah solutions, but we have to look differently. Not through the eyes of our immediate ancestors who were stuck without political entities or significance for the last 2,000 years. They were faced with different challenges and they answered them successfully, else we wouldn't have been here today. But they weren't faced with any of those political challenges I've just mentioned. And therefore, to a great extent, the Torah Shebaal Peh, which emerged after Bar Kokhba's time from Mishnah onwards, doesn't have too much to tell us about these challenges, but the Torah Shebichtav does, and the Tanakh does. And using our love, affection, and commitment to Torah Shebaal Peh, and the methodologies and the inspiration of Torah Shebaal Peh, we can revisit Torah Shebichtav and ask from HaKadosh Baruch Hu guidance, at least, to resolving some of these challenges going forward. That's the introduction. Anybody want to ask anything before I start? Okay. Last time I mentioned that there's a difference between nation and state, a difference well developed by Elazar and Rabbi Sachs. A nation is a place which gives identity. It tells us who we are, what's worth living for, what should I prepare to sacrifice my life for? Even more, what should I prepare to encourage my children to sacrifice their lives for? That's what identity really means. And identity emerges from families, which connect into communities, which become tribes, and which end up as nations. So again, the chain is families, communities, tribes, nations. And I don't think I need to explain to you. I suspect you understand what I'm talking about. But it's that structure which tells us who we are and for what we live. There is another parallel structure. You can call it federalism. You can call it all different nice names. It exists both in modern political science and in Torah Kabbalah as well. There is another structure which dominates our political life, that of the state and of local government, the state and the city. And those elements, they don't tell us who we are. Those elements see us only as numbers, or if they are just ones, they see me primarily not as Shlomo Ben Zvi, married to Sarah, and these are my children, and these are my friends, and my community, Tiferet Avot, and my tribe, Tzinut Tatit, and my nation, Am Yisrael. That's irrelevant to a state. A state knows me as 0, 1, 5, 1, 5, 3, 4. A state knows me as a number, and so it should. And it should, if it's a just state, not distinguish between the numbers, regardless of their gender, of their beliefs, of their family, political or socioeconomic affiliations. It's not important. You are a number. And a number helps us be the same. States, if they're just, and most states in the world are far from as just as we are, see citizens as numbers and therefore as equal. And so do cities, and so do states as well. States seem to be like little cities, seem to be like little states doing the services or providing the services that states can't or don't want to provide. But they fundamentally see us as individuals, whereas nations, tribe, communities see us in relationships as people of meaning. The two different structures provide two different answers to questions. As I said, a nation, a community, a tribe tells me who I am. Whom should I live for? Whom should I prepare to die for? And a state tells me, no, how much resources am I taking from the collective? And how am I going to divide, allocate those resources? A state can be a just one, doing it in an equitable fashion, ways which Tzedakah U'Mishpat HaKadosh Baruch Hu is very insistent that whenever we have a state, it acts under rules of Tzedakah U'Mishpat. Be fair, be just, don't oppress people, take it in an equitable way, and distribute the funds in an equitable way, not like Marx would suggest, or even like liberal philosophy would suggest. Use principles of justice to receive the funds, or take funds, or resources, and then allocate them. But that's all a state does. It takes and allocates resources. It may seem like a dry technical term, but it's the foundation of justice in this world. And you have good states who do it as much as possible, but tzedek u'mishpat. And you have bad states like, I don't know, Russia today, which are kleptomaniac, in which it's led by corrupt people who steal and steal for themselves and don't distribute to others. But they're both states. State is a merely an expression of a political geographic entity which takes resources and then allocates resources. You can be a good state, you can be a bad state. A state is an entity belonging to a source of values, and those values can be good values and can be bad values, but the values don't come from the state. The values come from the other chain, from the nation, the tribe, the community. So for going back to Russia, Russian national values says that the leader, the kleptomaniac who happens to be in charge, takes for himself and his fellow gangsters. Who cares about the rest? Because they're looking after the national values of Russia. It comes from the values. Think about the American Constitution. They talked about values which are inherent in nature. They didn't know what was inherent in nature. They just felt these are values bigger than the United States, than the states of America. These are values external to whatever they were, life, pursuit of happiness, etc., based on Locke's thinking. Values come from outside the state and determine how good or bad the state's going to be. I'm stopping to ask if everybody understands what I just said. It's what I talked about in last year, and Rabbi Sachs talked about it extensively. Two chains of political structures, the nation on the one hand, the state and the city on the other, two ways of viewing political man. And once you realize there are two, I'm sorry, I didn't stop. I'm stopping again to see if anybody wants to ask anything. And once you realize that there are two, it makes sense, and again, I spoke about this last time, to realize that they need different bodies representing us. We can't all do everything most of the time. So the state has a Knesset, a parliament, a congress, in which we represented it one-on-one, pachot yoter. So many people elect a certain number of congressmen who vote in the lower houses of Congress. But the nation's different. The nation also needs its bodies of representation, but there, instead of representing individuals, you represent sometimes communities, But more often, you represent tribes, and tribes are very amorphous things. Last time I explained to you why the American states, the 13 which founded the United States and today the 51, were similar to tribes. There's nothing real about a state. It's just happened to be these are the borders. But they developed a culture of thinking, a closeness, a community representation of their own. And they wanted Minnesota rights to be heard in their Senate, not just California rights. Why? Ma'evdel, kacha. Hakacha is pretty meaningless for the Goyim. But for the Jewish people, it's not. For the Jewish people, it's the tribal affiliation. I don't mean Dan and Gad and Naphtali. That's even less meaningful than Minnesota. I mean the ways in which we work for Kodesh Baruch Hu, the ways in which we self-identify today. You ask a Jew in Israel, and I know that because I read the polls, they do it every year, who you are, who am I? Well, over 90% give you one of the four following answers. Those are our tribes today. There may be more tribes if some emerge, but those are the four big. Nothing else achieves more than 2 or 3%. Those are the tribal affiliations of the Jewish people today. And they require a representative house as well. And last time I spoke to you about a second house, a house in which a national conversation, a conversation about values can and should be encouraged, and resolutions which can be achieved, which are separate from the Knesset, which allocates resources. You wanted to ask something, good, please.
Yeah, but you can't have a conversation with people that basically say you don't have a right to that opinion.
You may be right, but then it works like this,
and that's the current scenario. The current scenario is, and it's continuing, that you're canceled for your opinion. You know, you're thrown. You're against protests for a political reason in the medical association. They throw you out.
You're right.
That's the current state.
You're right, and that's a state which increasingly they'll be less able to dominate because as time goes on, there's less of them, and they care less, and the intensity of their fight will go.
They don't have to care. They're funded.
Yeah, I know, but don't get too excited about that. I'm not saying that it won't lead us. I started off by saying, I think you're right. I think that unless we come up with something which is more compelling than the present fight, unless we manage to reframe it and offer a positive goal, we're headed for some very rocky times ahead because of what you said, because they're funded, because at the moment they have power economically, militarily, business-wise. And that momentary power they know is slipping away, and they want to grab onto it now rather than 20 years' time when they won't have that power. So there is a danger now. But the way to confront that danger, and I'll come back to this at the end of my shiur, is to offer something alternative, something else which takes away, dramatically reduces their support, cuts their knees out from under them by taking away that large mass of people who are really crying out for protection of their values, but don't feel as militant as the 20% who are funded, who are horrible people, as you correctly probably intended.
Yeah, but even the other side of that is that even with a right-wing style government, you can't do anything because the attorney general, for example, won't indict, and then the court won't find guilt. So you have the system stacked against you.
You're right, and as you'll understand at the end of this year, it's time now for constitutional change. And constitutional change will require some sort of national compromise. And I'll be suggesting something practical in a few minutes, which enables us to say, look, this is our program. This gives you the value protection you urgently desire. But then you have to realize that we need to maintain democratic norms at a national level as well. And you'll be able, I believe, to buy off a significant part of the left, therefore reducing their ability to speak for more than a small crowd. They will remain a dangerous minority in the Jewish people who will instigate, together with foreign sources, trouble and civil war for the foreseeable future. You will not be able to eradicate them, and I don't want to. All we need to do is to take away from them the majority, not the silent, but the troubled, frightened, suspicious majority that they're now using to pretend that they're half the people. And I believe we can do that. It requires positive action, no longer sitting on our tuchus and saying, let's hope that Kadosh Baruch will help us get out of it, or praying that a few politicians who have no idea how to resolve this, and if we go into a real constitutional crisis in the next month, they have absolutely nothing to add to our conversation because they're stuck. And as you correctly said, the system has ground to a halt. We need to offer a new system. Will it be accepted immediately? Absolutely not. Are there practical things which we can do to start the change ground up? Absolutely, yes. And it's by showing how change happens on the ground that people understand and join change. It's by demonstrating how change works that you make change effective, then compelling, and then it becomes a vision. So this is not theoretical, what I'm going to be talking about. It's practical. It's real. But it has to be done and not talked about. It has to come from below and not be a top-down solution. And that sounds rather vague. Give me 10 more minutes, you'll understand what I'm talking about. Because I'm assuming that you're right. I'm assuming that whatever, how bad the situation is, things are going to get much, much worse in a month or two when the court's going to create a constitutional logjam in which we can't resolve it. I'm opening brackets now, like Lloyd George did in 1905 in England, or like Roosevelt did in the 1940s in the United States, when the Supreme Court blocked the parliament then. For various reasons, the solutions they had won't work here in Israel. And it's up to us to reframe the question, not through debates and dusiach and compromises like it's been suggested. That's not going to work. Through something positive, bigger, which also goes a long way to resolving the other issues, the other challenges I talked about. Closing brackets. How can we do it? Differentiating between those two ways of governing man. What provides identity and what provides resources. I know this sounds theoretical. I'm feeding into something practical now. The first practical implication is that at a national level, you need a Knesset, which I think urgently needs to have regional representation, no longer political representation. It's long overdue. Endless committees have agreed it. It's not so hard. It works in most of the world, and it creates a real connection between the local and the national. And that's something which every citizen, Jew and Arab, can be equal in. But you also need a House of Lords or a Senate or a People's House. We're representing the Jewish people, and I'm not going to repeat the shift from last time, but that deals with our national questions. That's where I don't want to go. I want to go a different way altogether today. Because what occurred to me, and that's something I've been teaching and writing about for the last few years, the need for a second house, a house representing the Jewish people, in its entirety, to discuss and decide the values. And you can just say in the end, it'll be majoritarian votes. You can say it'll be like the Senate, where each tribe has equal weight and you need representatives from all tribes to find a solution. You can say the solutions will always be temporary, so you have a dynamic constitution. These are fascinating subjects, which I have and are happy to talk about separately, but they're not today's subject. We're moving away from the national to something even more important than how we decide our national values. Because in the last 6 months, what's emerged is a concern not for how we resolve national values. That may happen in the next year, that the anger of the left turns against the Mitnachalim as well and against nationalism and tries to find the moment the Arabs are not playing along with the left and therefore they can't really connect to them. That may change. At the moment, the issue is our personal identity. We are frightened that all the values that we believe in will be challenged by the Haredi values who are going to swamp us now, and we don't believe in their values. Now, we don't agree with either of those values, really. And with some extent, we're standing on the side and saying, you know, you're both right. But I'm not interested who's right or wrong. I'm interested in reducing the level of fear, suspicion, and tension, cutting out the legs from underneath of the troublemakers that you mentioned, and creating a real positive way forward that we can build this country in a way which will answer the political challenges I mentioned earlier. How do we do it? Not on a national level. Because what emerged in the last 6 months is that the fears are not national fears, but fears of individual personal identity, challenges which everybody in the West are facing at the moment. Real identity issues are matters of gender, matters of sexual orientation, matters of who we are as a person, to be a Jew, not to be a Jew. What does it mean? Who can tell me how to live my life? Who says who is a legitimate Jew? These are issues that really bother, forgive me for using generalizations, Tel Aviv, bother Bnei Barak, bother us less. And that's why we are well positioned to answer them, because we're more tolerant, we're more accepting, we're as confused as anybody else. But we know that we can live with both sides of the quandary. They can't. And unless we do something about it, they're going to tear the country apart. So how do we resolve that issue? And this is where Daniel Elazar and Rabbi Sachs' thinking is at its most powerful. You see, when you create a national political structure, modern political thought has taught us, and actually it's not modern political thought, it's throughout the Tanakh, and again, that requires a different shiur, a separation of power. Separation of power doesn't mean what the Israeli press or even Forum Kohelet is telling us today. It's not how you define the relationship between the government and the judiciary, and of course there's a parliament as well. That's not what separation of powers is about. The word power is wrong. It's separation of authorities, or better still, rishuyot. Now, we as people who understand Hebrew know that the word rishuyot comes from rishut. And if you remember Jewish history, every book that was printed always had a rishut. Who gave you the authority to teach, to write, to publish your particular work? What is the source of your authority? Rishut, at least in Mishpat Ivri, comes to signify who gave you the authority. Who gives you the right? And to us as modern people, the answer is simple. You need democracy. You need liberal representation. People give consent, and that's how others represent them. Birshut. You are my shaliach because I voted for you. I may not have voted for you, but I voted for the system. But by voting, I agreed with the system. How many rishuyot are there in Israel today? Well, anybody will tell you from Ezrachut HaMuz, Rishut HaShofetet, Rishut HaMemshala, Rishut HaMechokeket. Shtuyot. It's not true. Of all the rishuyot in Israel today, only one is a true rishut, or one and a half is a true rishut. That's the Knesset. We vote for the Knesset. The Memshala is not democratically elected. It's elected based on a certain haggling and horse trading by Chavrei Knesset. They're not directly elected by us. They owe us nothing, as we know well, after so many rounds of elections. Certainly, the judiciary are not elected. They have no rishut either. The way they are elected is the issue of fighting at the moment. But who's the fighting between? It's between the memshala, who are not elected, and between the judiciary, who are not elected. But they both agree one thing, that the only people who shouldn't have anything real to say are the Knesset, whose influence has been minimized, has been diminished, has been miniaturized over the last 30 years, steadily, more and more, by a memshala, which makes up nearly every Chavre Knesset on the coalition, and by the judiciary, which vacuums all the power out of the system and keeps it to itself. The moment you've got a clash between these two sources of power, government and judiciary, neither of them are democratic. The first principle of understanding separation is it's a separation of democratic powers. In the United States, the original idea was that you represent yourself both in the Congress, lower house, upper house. There's elections now directly, forget the Electoral College, to presidency as well. And the original idea was that you give judges power only when they're elected as well. And still in most states, United States, you elect judges. I'm not suggesting we should do that in Israel. But you have to understand that sources of separation are sources of authority which come from us, the people, who represent people. And in Israel, only one source or one and a half sources of true authority, rishut, exist, the Knesset. First of all, power's got to go back to the Knesset, away from the government, away from the judiciary, back to the Knesset. Those are the people who really represent us democratically, and they have to give a din v'cheshbon to us every so many years at the Kalfi. We're not talking about that, but I wanted to show to you how the idea of Afradat Rishuyot is so different from what you're told every day in the media, both on right and left. I'm talking about a different separation of powers, which in itself is deeply embedded in the Tanakh and very much in the Torah from Parshat Bereshit and onwards as well. In Hebrew, there's a word for it, a nice, easy word. In English, is a big word. In English, it's devolvement. But in Hebrew, it's an easy word to remember, bizur. You take a federal level of government, but you have a local level of government as well, state and city. And you devolve, in Hebrew, levazer. You reduce the authority of the national government, and you increase the authority of the local government. Why is that morally important? Isn't it just shifting power amongst politicians? Really, really not. Let me explain why not. When you have a federal government, you have people, whether they call themselves Shoftei Bet Mishpat Elyon or chief rabbis, who think that by virtue of the fact that they have to look after everybody, they know what's best for everybody. And everybody else is slightly less enlightened than them. I'm not just talking about Shoftei Bet Mishpat Elyon who actually say that. I'm talking about the chief rabbis who call everybody else Tinokot Shenishba, or less committed than them, or Ra'ui Litchazek, or any other concept. In other words, the Mamlachtiut that we were all educated on is fundamentally not suitable for Israel today. It was absolutely spot on when we needed to create a state and survive against our immediate neighbors. That's gone. We're here. Survival is probably not an issue until we ruin our state internally. So what needs to reemerge is that sense of separation horizontal, I talked about, vertically, between the national level, federal level, whatever you want to call it, and the local level. Why does that make a difference? Because when you give local power, something strange happens. Two important statements are being made. One, that things can be different. Values, priorities of one local government can and always are different than values and priorities of another local government. Okay, I'll explain that idea in a minute. But that's one huge difference, as opposed to having one for all, and everybody who's not quite there is not as enlightened or as frum as they need to be. So the one first big change between having everything at the top like in Israel's today, and Israel's really Stalinistic in its deterministic approach, everybody has to fit into one mold, to reducing and allowing power to local government, it includes the very obvious but dramatically powerful idea of having lots of different values, having lots of the different legitimate worldviews. And second of all, there's something else about local government which can't, by the very nature, exist in federal government, and that is our local influence. You can, as an individual, better still, as a community of families, you really can have a voice in local government, especially in Israel. We have so much local government, but let's face it, you really can't have a voice in national politics. In the end, Lieberman, Lapid, even Bibi, they decide their own lists. They have all sorts of mechanisms. They decide. You can't really have an influence. It's based on the guys at the top. We're only little irrelevant people, but local government, families, communities come together. They have a huge say. And that means you can't ignore the other with a big O. That means you can't ignore people who are slightly different than yourselves, who think differently from yourselves. And any compromise is not a top-down solution worked out by academics, but something real, organic, which grows from the fact that we live together as neighbors, and we live together as people who want to carry on living together and recognize that not everybody's like us and people have different worldviews to ourselves, but we want to carry on living together. And therefore, we have to make room, make grounds, make space for other people, benefit them because we want to be good neighbors. Shachem Tov, according to Pirkei Avot, is one of the highest ideals of a Jewish polity. Local government has those two powerful ideas, and it challenges the centrality, it challenges the dominance of federal thinking, of federal speak, all as one. Do as we tell you, says Bagatz. Do like you should do, says Rabbanut HaRashit. And both those models are no longer suitable for the Jewish people. And if we carry on strengthening them, they will rip the Jewish people apart. Because it turns out that since Yaakov had, fortunately or not, more than one child, it turns out that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to be 12 tribes. And each of those 12 tribes has a slightly subtly different way of viewing him, viewing the Jewish people, viewing their commitment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But it turns out also that HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want to give up on any one of those tribes. Kahal Adat Yisrael is the only way HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates covenant with the Jewish people. All tribes together. Now we may think, we may know that we're the only really, really good tribe. And everybody else is, they didn't get the education, they don't understand the value of the army, they're total goyim, no bemet. Everybody else sits at the Seder table and thinks he's the Ben HaChacham. And there's three other Banim sitting around the table, but everybody thinks that. Everybody thinks he's the Chacham and everybody else is the Tam. There's truth in all of that. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu somehow is bigger than you and me. And he seems to want all the Jewish people, all the Jewish tribes that recognize him, and to a great extent, even the majority of the Chilonim do in their strange, incorrect, convoluted way. He wants them at the table. And the only way that's going to happen is if we stop being mamlachtim in a limited sense, not so limited, in a real sense, and start giving space for alternative ways of being Jewish. But that only happens at the local government as well. You can't do it on a federal level when you need one army, when you need in the end one foreign policy. And as people, a lot of those of you who have come from the United States, you know it does work. You have a federal government which decides national policy, foreign policy, military policy. But in theory, in the United States, the theory has gone out the window in the last 50 years. But in theory, the idea was your real identity comes from your community, your hometown, your shared civic values, and the state in which you lived. And there was a federal government which you tried not to interfere too much. That's changed a lot since World War II for reasons I won't express today. But in Israel, it started out bad, and we can blame the Turks and then the British. But the real source of problems wasn't the Turks or even the British. Actually, the Turks and the British both gave us a really good structure for local government. The people who ruined everything were the socialists who came from Eastern Europe. And they thought the way to run a country was one speak. We have it was one party, one voice, one set of dominant values, and we're going to educate you to be like us because we want you to be like us. Because in some way we think we're the best and everybody else has got to fit in. And they were right. Rav Kook talks about the fact that in the time where Kadosh Baruch Hu wants Lashiv Mamlachal Israel, he died, of course, before the establishment of the State of Israel, he was asked how, given the fact that throughout the Nevi'im, the tribes are all going to come back and the tribes are going to be different, how can we set up then one state or one Mamlacha without it being exposed to the same problems which destroyed the Jewish state in the past? And he said something amazing. He said this 15 years before the establishment of the state. He said, Kadosh Baruch Hu will do a miracle. And for one period in Jewish history, he will eradicate tribalism from the Jewish people. And one tribe will dominate. And he was right. And because there was one way of thinking, we managed to establish a state. And that carried on for the last 75 years. And then he went on to say, Shebador ha-shlishi ha-davar zeh yigamer, v'yitzmach michadash ha-shift yuta yisraelit. It's in Orot HaTchiyah at the end. V'zeh siman lebiat. Eliyahu Navi. I don't know what that means, Eliyahu Navi. But I do know that today we are seeing real emergence of Jewish tribalism anew. We can't carry on living as we are with each other. We need to talk about federal structures. That's not the part of this shiur. I've talked about it and I've talked about Aliyah Regel. But I just want to mention one thing because people always ask me, okay, if we believe in extreme tribalism, how comes we won't fall apart as a nation? The truth is the nation is not tribal and the nation is not unitary. It's the power between the two. It's the dynamic of moving perpetually, sometimes physically, between the tribal and the monarchical or the central, back to the tribal. That pula is called Aliyah Regel. That's not this shi'ur. But there are mechanisms in the Tanakh, the Davidic principle, which allow us continuously to re-energize that central line of thinking, but to spend most of our lives within our own tribe. But it's not just our tribe, because otherwise you become Bnei Brak. Everybody thinking the same, even Bnei Brak, they don't. And the way to make sure that we manage to maintain our respect for the other, without which in the end there is no respect for HaKadosh Baruch Hu's diverse world, is to realize that in local government, if you empower local government, you force people, on the one hand, to take responsibility for the other because they have accepted upon themselves the distribution of resources to the other as well. You, Malasot, if you want to be responsible for local educational policy, if you want the resources to be able to dictate who gets more, who gets less, that's what values is all about, then you have to have responsibility for the other, even though you don't agree with their opinions, even though you can't stand their opinions, even though you thoroughly disagree with their opinions, they're there, they're neighbors. And you take responsibility. That's why you got the resources to allocate according to the values you've agreed upon as a community. That's the theoretical part of my shiur. In other words, we need not just a separation of powers lamala, we need separation of powers from lamala, from above to below, a vertical separation of powers. All that's theory, now practice. I'm stopping for a second. Do everybody understand the theory, the theoretical part I'm talking about?
Yeah, but the problem, one of the problems that you mentioned, that you hint on, is if you have the separation where local policy is made by local people, the problem is the taxes doesn't come from local people.
You're absolutely right. It's not just taxes. You're absolutely right. Also, the allocation of money.
80% of the population pay 80% of the taxes. And that 20%, from the Gush Dan area is not going to want to share that value.
Doesn't quite work like that, but if you want me to talk specifically about tax theory, I can.
I have another question. So I'm sure, what prevents having like civil war like they had in America?
Nothing.
If each state says I want to, I'm for slavery. What right do the states have to say you can't do slavery? Or Shabbat? Tel Aviv will say we're totally not Shomer Shabbat, and it's what are we going to do about it? Nothing. That's the regulation.
Avi, unfortunately, you put your finger on the most difficult and perplexing of questions. My answer to that is beyond the confines of this shiur, is a combination of periodic covenanting as a people and Aliyah LaRegel, which always creates that unity and then allows diversity. The truth is, Avi, historical precedent doesn't look good. There are nearly no examples apart from David HaMelech throughout human history that I know of, and I'm not. I don't know all human history, but what I've studied in which people have successfully managed to overcome the challenges we're starting to face now without a civil war. If we
Mordechai Kadar is fond of pointing out that the successful Arab states are those that are tribally based on a local level with a federalist superstructure, and that the failed states are ones which do not recognize the tribalism.
I see myself to a great extent, and a good friend of mine is a Talmid of Mordechai. I greatly value his thinking, but I would challenge his word successful Arab states. Chas v'sholom, we should be as successful as those successful Arab states. And it's not a laughing matter because they're looking to us. I know they may not say so directly, but most of the world thinks that we're smart, not just in high tech. And they expect the Jewish people to be smart in tzedakah, mishpat, and politics as well. And it's about time we started showing the world that we're here not just to serve their need for further applications and cybersecurity, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu kept us going as a people because his world needs somebody to show the way to resolve political, social issues as well, and not just matter applications and high tech. It's our special genius. It's what we've been training for the last 2,000 years. We're really, really good at this. The Goyim seem to know that. We need occasionally to get a knock on the head to realize, it's something we urgently need to resolve. And I'm telling you, we need to start resolving it now because, as I said at the beginning, my shield, the vector's changing and time is not going to be on our side if we don't come up with some positive models. And let me get back to the models so we have something positive to think about. Power comes from local government because power and local government, as I said, I'm just summarizing what I said before, has two advantages. One, it shows you can have legitimate differences. Yes, Avi, you're right. We need afterwards principles which bind them together, whether they're Aliyah LaRegel or covenant, different shiurim. But let's leave that very difficult question aside and come back to what local government really means and how you do it. So, one, it legitimizes difference and diversity. Two, it forces us to confront the other, somebody who thinks differently from us. Because if we just said, let's give power to communities, then Kehillat Kedoshah Bels would decide what Bels want, and Gur would decide what Gur wants, and everybody would live in communities. Cities, like states, force you to confront the other. In Malasot, even in Haredi communities, they have to live with Hashem Yirachem Sfaradim, and they have to live with Chozrim B'Tshuva, and they have to live with other Hasidic cults who think differently from them. To us, they all look the same. To them, they're as different as penguins from South America and North Antarctica and the Atlantic. They're different. And by living as neighbors, not just as family members, we're suddenly forced to confront the other and makes room for the other, because that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu seems to be telling us throughout the Torah. Let's see how you can relate to the other who thinks a little bit differently, who behaves a little bit differently from your own within moral guidelines of the Torah. So that's what local government has to offer. How do you do it? It won't work by waiting for politicians to divest themselves of power. That ain't going to happen. At least it hasn't happened so far in human history. I'm not sure it's going to start happening in Israeli history either. Power comes, or better still, the ability to influence and choose values comes when two things happen: when people demand it from below, and also they prepare themselves rationally, reasonably, to accept the resources, to accept the power, to accept the influence they want after to distribute. You've got to do two things. You've got to protest and you've got to demand. It doesn't have to be chaining yourself to fences and protests. I'll explain how it's done in a moment. But it's also got to be getting ready. It's also got to be preparing ourselves to responsibly receive those funds and allocate them with reason. And you've got to show you can do that. But one plays off the other. Show you can do it, you get more power and influence. Get more power and influence, it encourages more people to participate in that process of showing I can do it, and it's a virtuous circle. That's how power is redistributed. The truth is it happens somewhat differently. And I'm going to open the historical brackets a second. In Israel, in the United States, and a bit more confused in England as well, true power sources came from before the federal government, from local government, from the states in the United States, what Elazar called civic communities. In Israel, the idea was from Moshavot to Medina. If you know your Jewish Zionist history, in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, the real power was in various local structures, which then together, hitagdu, formed federations of one sort or another, and eventually became a state. You know, ideally, you have local power, you get used to using local power, you get used to compromising, making room for differences, agreeing to work together, and by adding one to another, to another, to another, you create confederations and eventually federal power. That got cut off in Israel. The process was started, Ben-Gurion, for reasons which I think I can agree with him, realize you need to be mamlachti, otherwise we're not going to have a state, squashed all sources of power outside the one party, one state system. In the end, he ended up regretting it deeply. And he wrote in his biography towards the end of his life, it was the biggest cancer, he called it, which introduced the Israeli social political body. But it was too late. And you may have thought that in 77, when the first tribe left and the second tribe reemerged, that would change. And it didn't change. On the one hand, there were seeds sown in the 1970s and 80s for real change, which happened in Israel. It happened because local government had completely collapsed, had been dominated by political appointments, by corruption, and by major parties influencing and meddling influence low down and lower government. And everybody realized something had to change. And a big change came along in the early 80s, not in a little way influenced by Daniel Azar and a famous committee called Vadat Zambar, which for 10 years sat and thought, some of the best minds, political minds in Israel and the Jewish people. They came up with amazing recommendations. Of course, the government accepted them and did nothing. But two important things changed in local government. Number one, the date for the elections was changed from the same as the national to a fixed term of 5 years, every 1st or every 31st of October, every 5 years. I think what a blessing that is in retrospect compared to the national level now. And it also separated. It means the political parties didn't get so involved. The other big change was they made the man in charge, the chief executive, let's call him the president, the mayor, a self-directly appointed, democratically appointed man of the people. Therefore, giving him personal power, personal ability to influence them directly because of his power from the people. That happened in the 80s, and nobody knew what the implications of that, nobody thought it through like everything in Israel, but slowly two things emerged. Slowly, the local government increased in power, and local government increased in its independence from national government. And today, 80-something percent of mayors and mayoral parties are totally independent from the national parties. And that's wonderful because it means there's less corruption, less influence, and many more people who are totally committed to getting the local right without caring what goes on at a national level. That happened by mistake, like those things in Israel, and was a bracha in itself and was heading in a good direction. And then came along Aryeh Deri and Bibi, two people whose contribution to this country is very, very questionable, and I doubt history will see either of them positively. The Aryeh Deri as the internal Sarapanim, he's still Sarapanim, despite pointing his shamash to be there instead today, together with Bibi's backing, and Bibi was equally responsible, created law after law which eradicated the emerging power and the emerging influence and the emerging bizur, devolvement of power from local government. I won't go into details now. They're absolutely fascinating how they took away the control of Arnona, how they recreated various commissions which took away all educational influence from local government, from parents, from teachers, and centralized it all under government officials far away in Jerusalem, trying to create this one-fits-all model, which has been and is a total failure in Israel. When I talk to teachers and schools, I tell them, and they all laugh, but they all agree with me, that there are two great challenges to teach us today. And it's not modernity. It's A, smartphones, because kids don't pay attention. And two, it's Misrad HaChinuch. Close both those down. Education goes through the sky in this country. And Misrad HaChinuch, like in Israel, like throughout Europe and the United States, is a total failure because they spend their time trying to fit everybody into molds, which don't work, because everybody is and should be different. That change of local government, which started in the 80s, was squashed by Bibi and the Derry for the last 35 years. Until today, things have been similar. You've had only some local governments emerging. Who emerged? Turns out that some local governments were good, really good at making money. How do you make money in local government? There's only one way left. The national government has taken away all sources of taxation, all sources of authoritative tax revenue, apart from one. They haven't yet had the gall to touch spending or arnona, which comes from businesses. So if you have lots of thriving businesses and retail and higher education centers in your local council, that money comes to you. You can do with what you like. You can improve the citizens' lives. You can add culture. You can add educational facilities. You can add cultural events. You can also change things because money helps you do things. Otherwise, all the money you get, you simply act as a kablan bitzua, as somebody who receives and passes on funds received from a national government. So to summarize this point, local government started really well in the Likud tribe, but it ran out of energy when Derry and Bibi stepped on it and reduced it back to its next to nothing. Funny enough, for the last 5 years, that's changing again. Last 5 years, democracy, liberal thinking, change has re-emerged at the local level. People to local level are taking charge of their lives, creating values. The real change came during Corona, just 3 or 4 years ago, when it was local government rather than national government that stepped in and saved the day. They were so organized, so committed, so well thought out that they actually could do things the national government and our famous Tzal was unable to do. And once you start taking power back, you don't let it escape so easily. And if you look carefully at what's been happening the last 6 months, you'll see the increasing involvement of local civil leaders and local authorities in the fight against the government and in Yesha in the fight against the government, because people start to realize that there are no solutions, no survival mechanisms, no great ideas coming top downwards. It's only going to emerge from down below, people committed to something. So how do you do it? And that's my last 5 minutes. How do you go about doing it? Well, local government in Israel allows you to directly elect two tickets. One is directly elect a mayor, and that's a very powerful thing because he then owes you his allegiance. He doesn't owe anything to anybody else above him. And two, to elect a council. And that's also very powerful. But the council's job is very, very, very circumscribed, very, very prescribed. Basically, it can approve a budget, bring up issues for discussion, but it has no power. It has no real executive power. It certainly has no power, no authority to deal with the value questions I've been talking about for the last hour. And that's where new thinking is required, not just at the national level, but the local level as well. We need to create local government, which has two houses, just like the upper government needs to have a Knesset and an upper house, a Senate, a House of the Lords, which deals with an ongoing dynamic conversation of values, priorities, and reaches values, solutions which are good for each area. You need it at a local level as well. You need one Moatza, and you need one community council. You need an Asifat Kehilot, which at this first stage will receive its power from the only source of power in local government, from the mayor himself, but whose job it is to hear the people and to come up after having relevant conversations with value decisions on four key areas, because you can't just stay theoretical forever. You're allowed to discuss religious values and have a fight with the Misrad HaDatot, but Guts will back you. You're allowed to have a discussion and reach resolutions about content of teaching and who should teach and what should be paid to an education and cultural issues, and you'll be fighting Misrad HaChinuch, and in the end, you'll win that fight because Misrad HaChinuch is a vacuous, and to some extent, hollow body, which the courts will not back. I don't know if you know this, but a recent document suggested that 3,600 out of the 3,800 people who work in Misrad HaChinuch in Yerushalayim are totally mutar. You can't work out what they do. They do less than nothing. They try and fit everybody into one mool. We don't need them at all. But unless you have people who can take responsibility at a local level, who say, we are here, we're responsible, give us the resources, it's never going to happen. So that's education, that's social religious services. Then you have social services themselves. Ravacha today is thrown on local government without the resources. Get ready to distribute them, understand the difficulty of prioritizing them, and you can demand those resources as well. And Mishrad Ravacha is not strong enough to stand up to a public demand for relief resources. And lastly, planning. Planning is a critical issue. At the moment, for reasons beyond belief, it was swallowed up by that octopus of state organisms, the Mishrad HaPanim. And for no good reason, they control planning everywhere in the country. Ki'ilu, they understand planning requirements of committee, of cities, of local areas. They understand nothing, but they know influence, and they smell money, and they run there. They need to be disbanded, but they will only be disbanded if we demand that local planning committees receive the power, receive the resources, receive the legal authority that at the moment the Mishrad HaPanim hogs for itself. That's a process, but that's a relevant process, and one in which we lead, we tell everybody the following message. We're looking out for you creating your values. We're not going to let the Haredim dictate Tel Aviv. We're not going to let Tel Aviv dictate Ra'anana or Ra'anana dictate Efrat. If we are prepared to be responsible for our prioritization, for our values, then eventually we'll get the resources we need and we'll be able to lead the lives we want to lead based on the values we believe in. That goes a very long way to reducing the fear, the tension, the suspicion, and thus the hatred, which a large part of the left today is working on to create, to incite trouble, to incite in the future civil war. Will it work? As Avi said, can we in the end avoid civil war? I don't know. But I do know that reducing tensions, allowing people, guaranteeing people that they can live lives in which their values control their lives on an individual level, not on a national level, will go a long way to reducing the power, the might of those who object to the government today. We will steal some of the thunder of those who are funded by foreign entities. We will avoid endless, unnecessary and wasteful discussions over clauses in laws, which in the end will make no difference at all. And most importantly, we'll be offering a new positive agenda to the Jewish people coming from our tribe. Jewish people say, ah, Kazer Ha'ev Chacham, what a wise tribe we have leading us. Thank God they're going to be assuming positions of leadership in the coming decade. We've got somebody who cares about all of us. Somebody who understands what's relevant to all of us, and somebody, because they're committed to Torah, understand that you've got to enable everybody to find their way back to Kodesh Baruch Hu, but their way and not my way. That's my practical suggestion for now. And as some of you know, I'm going to be trying in the next 2 months to create that change here in Efrat. I'm going to be running not only for mayor here in Efrat, but trying to put together a list and a community council, which will demonstrate, not through theoretical arguments, demonstrate how here in Efrat we can take the very meager resources we're left with and start using them and demand more. And there are things that a mayor can do, which no mayor in the country has yet done. Hatzalat samchuyot, giving authority over to community councils to enable people to say, okay, step up. You've got lots of different people in your neighborhood. Let's see how you resolve the issues. I will give them the authority. I'll give them resources, if they're prepared to shoulder responsibility. And it's through example, it's through successful, it won't always be successful, but through successful operations like that, that you really lead, not just local government, but a whole nation. And that's what I'm trying to do. Thank you for listening. And now I'll take your questions.
Quick question. There are no native students.
Yes.
I know my son teaches in Yeruchim, and he says a teacher in Yeruchim makes 40% less than a teacher in Tel Aviv. Because Tel Aviv takes your arnona and subsidizes whatever.
Correct.
How do you deal with that issue? They tried the Karen arnona, and it was voted down or whatever.
Karen arnona is not going to work. But let me tell you, let me again open the sogrime, just explain two sentences how arnona works in this country. Residential arnona is fixed, is decided by Mishrad HaPanim. Local government has absolutely no control. Even the discounts you're forced to give, it's Chavri Knesset saying, you know what? I'm going to give 10% discount now to war veterans. And then they turn around and cut 10% from the money they're giving to local governments, who have to then make cuts themselves. It's politicians being gadol, being big on the cheshbon of somebody else, from local services, which are already badly cut throughout the country. But what's more than that, residential arnona is worthless, which is why there's no residential building in the country, which is primarily why prices are so high. No local government in their right mind, maybe apart from Efrat, a few other places, wants to build local houses for people. Why? Every resident that comes in costs you money. He brings in arnona, and you can charge a fortune in Efrat. We pay some of the highest arnona in the country. But every new resident per person, not per family, costs you about 1,800 shekel per year in extra schools, in extra kupot chalim, in extra facilities, which under law you're obliged to provide. We have another 1,000 yichidot today in Zayit. That means we have to find roughly another 9 to 10 million shekel a year, which we have no way of finding here in Efrat, just to maintain the level of services we've got. So how do you do it? The answer is Tel Aviv. The answer is what I said before. There is one loophole the government hasn't yet managed to close because they're frightened of Tel Aviv, of Modi'in, of Rishon. And that is arnona iskit, commercial arnona. That comes in, that's worth three or four times as much as residential arnona per meter. But there's no charge against it. There's no schools for shops. There's no kupat chalim. There's no other legal requirements. It's netto money in the local government's pocket. So you want businesses? You don't want residents. That's the crazy way the government works today. That's why nobody wants to build houses. That's what Karen and Anna tried to rectify, and it'll get nowhere at all. You need businesses. You want to be a successful mu'atza, a successful city, you're tested by one criteria only. How many shops? How many offices? How many kupat cholim, which pay nice money? How many financial institutions, which pay lovely money? How many shopping centers and how many academic institutions, all those factories, not so much, pay real money, which stays locally. What do you do? You can't pay yourself more as a mayor. That's fixed by government. But that's the money you can use to improve education, to pay teachers extra special, extra curriculum, tosefet chinuch, tosefet la tosefet shla chinuch. You can add janitors and cleaners and heaters. You can't touch the curriculum, but kol misaviv, you can add a lot. That's how you can add more of the revacha. Do you know that in Efrat, we've reduced by nearly two-thirds of their revacha? Why? Because we have no money. Look around. We have no shops of substance, no businesses in Efrat. Look what they're doing in Gush Etzion. Look how poorly we've fared here. We have no money because we have no money outside residential arnona, which is a burden rather than a benefit. So what a city needs to do is to create sources of income so it can provide those rich sources resources that we were also used to when we brought up our children here in Efrat 15, 20 years ago. Efrat's going like this on every scale, every possible indicator, just because we haven't got any more money, and money's important. If you don't have shops, if you don't have higher education, if you don't have businesses, you cannot provide a quality of life to teachers, to young families, to elderly people. You simply can't, because there's no money for it at all. And the government handout are so meager as to be laughable. So in answer to your question, Avi, we need, like most cities need, to have sources of income, which the government still doesn't take away, such as businesses. That's what Tel Aviv does. That's what Modi'in does. It spends all its money thinking up new ways to bring in business, to bring in technology. It also helps people have jobs in the area. There's so many benefits. But unless you do that, you are a poor city getting poorer. And eventually you become like the Haredi and Arab cities. And we're not so far from that today, in which you just basically go to government handouts. And depending on whether your name is Derry or not, or similar to that, you get money from the government like a schnorrer. So if you want to be a schnorrer state, carry on the way we're going, because we have no sources of income. If you want to be a place that can provide quality education by having properly paid teachers, by having a revacha department which can deal responsibly with the needs of our citizens, we need sources of income. And that means hard work, developing a plan, a realistic plan, and it doesn't happen overnight. That in 4 or 5 years' time, there's businesses in Efrat, there are shops in Efrat, there's retail, there's higher education in Efrat of substance, not two or three little shops. You need thousands of meters to bring in the amount of money we need, Baruch Hashem, of 15,500 people to provide the sort of services, Avi, that you and I enjoyed when our children were in school here. The present kids are getting far, far less. And it's our job to make sure they get, at the very least, what our children enjoyed 15 to 20 years ago. I know I shouldn't talk politics in the Shia, but, you know, I'm there. My mind space is there at the time. And I started out wanting to tell you about the theoretical implications and why Efrat can and needs to be an example to the whole Jewish state, and maybe beyond that as well, because here we have people who are serious and committed and responsible and caring and Torani. If we can't do it here, they can't do it anywhere else. So we're going to try and do it here. But we also have to bring businesses here. We also have to have higher education here. We also have to have real substantial retail, not 3.5 shops here, so that we can provide the quality of life that we think we deserve.
Okay, I'll jump in. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay, I agree with you that it's almost that we've, with all the regulation and oversight, we've almost criminalized opening a small business and opening a new business in Efrat and elsewhere. But it's so difficult and it takes so long and it's so expensive. And that seems to be one of the problems. But anyway, on to my point, your model bugs me in a way because I don't think it works with the scale that we have in Israel. The educational policy in California is not necessarily going to affect the educational policy in New York because it's a big country. But the educational policy in Tel Aviv will affect the educational policy in Yerushalayim. And a lot of the policy, there needs to be more, a stronger national framework in order to keep the, I guess, the country together. It's a small or medium-sized, it's the equivalent of a medium-sized state in the States. And you can't have so many individual opinions taking charge. There has to be a national structure.
It reminds me of the famous joke, you all know, that Golda Meir famously once supposed to have said to Nixon, said, you're a president, but I'm a president of, I think at the time, 6 million presidents. That's, the Jewish people are big. We may be small technically in numbers, but nobody knows that. It's a secret. The world and a Kodesh Baruch view us as very, very, very big. And what we do, even in a small way, has huge ramifications. Answer number one. Answer number two, when our American forefathers, they weren't mine, they were rebellions to my forefathers. But when the American founding fathers set up the United States, I think you know how many people then lived in the United States, less than live in Gush Dan today. And they came up with this complicated constitution for 3.5 million people spread over 13 states. And nachon, it expanded. You start right, you build the foundations correctly, and it expands from there. We are a big people, not in numbers, but in the way we behave. And yes, there will be an influence from Bnei Brak on Petach Tikva, on Ramat Gan, and Baruch Hashem, there will be. But today, with social media, you can create communities, real communities, political communities at a local level, and have different legitimate opinions, different world values. In Tel Aviv, men will call themselves married to men, Hashem Yirachem, Malasot. In Bnei Brak, they won't, and they'll live together without one authority telling them they're right or wrong. Until education, reality, and history proves that they have no grandchildren, and in Bnei Brak, they do have grandchildren.
But the federal structure, the federal government will have to decide whether that's a legitimate marriage.
No government has to be involved in marriage at all. It doesn't say anywhere in any political book that governments have to decide who's married. Government should not be involved in decisions regarding personal status at all. I'm 015. I don't know what your 2 number is. That's all. The government shouldn't know whether I'm married or not. Who to? It's not my name, Bichlal. Governments have got to get out of the issue of personal identity. And ba'ad, as you say in Hebrew, hafradat dat hamdina, aval hadbagat dat lakihila. I really want religion, my religion, as opposed to my neighbor's religion, discussed between us. I want to reach a compromise with my neighbor who happens to think differently than me because Ari Greenspan, who knows what he thinks. But I need to understand that my neighbor's different than me. And we all live with different neighbors. Even in Efrat, there's a multiplicity of values which need to be reconciled. Certainly, if you go to a bigger city, you will find a whole range of opinions. Zebaseda. But we've got to then find a way of dealing with it as neighbors, not having a federal government far away in Jerusalem telling us all what's right or wrong. Get away from this mamlachti thinking where you and I were educated. It's killing our Jewish state. It'll bring the end of our state if we're not careful, or a civil war. And I don't want to get either. I want to find a way round. And unless we do something, we're not going to find a way round. We're heading straight for it at the moment. So let's try and be proactive. Let's try and do it differently. Maybe a Kodesh Baruch Hu will give us Yata Dishmaya to succeed. Maybe. Thank you, Shlomo. All. Anybody else? Yes, Bruce.
With the immediate issue with the Supreme Court and the Knesset, what is the What's the resolution when we come to an impasse?
It's irrelevant. It's irrelevant. They're going to get stuck and nobody's going to know what to do. And Bibi will avoid the issue like he avoids all serious issues. And no refuah is going to come from there. And that's going to just exasperate things more and more, both on the Haredi and the Chiloni side. We need to reframe the argument and realize that it comes from us taking responsibility, which doesn't mean demonstrating either on Thursday night or Motzei Shabbos. It means doing things which other can learn from. It takes time. It doesn't take as much time as you think.
Can the Supreme Court right now cancel a basic law, for example? And what if they do?
So they do. Well, that's sort of, you know, carry on life will carry on the next day. That's not going to make any difference. And in the end, the politicians will do what they did in the 1830s and 1840s and 1850s. All the compromises you may or may not have heard of, every 5 years there's another great compromise. And it just moves the state closer and closer to civil war because you're just bottling up realities of huge differences which are not being resolved. And in the end, they had the explosion in the 1860s. That's what's going to happen in Israel unless we circumvent that, unless we come up with a new positive way of thinking and say, guys, it doesn't have to be that or that. It could be something else altogether. And look, it's not just us coming up with an interesting idea. We're making it happen. And if we're making it happen, you can try making it happen in your way. And eventually, quicker than you think, things become sticky. People see, you know what? They succeeded. Maybe we can succeed as well. And it becomes compelling. Success drives the story. We've got to start telling that story here in our little city. I've got to go now, everybody. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shlomo. Thank you very much.